point. Now, the only question is, do we understand a black hole as a pipe? Or we understand a black hole as it is accumulation of the energy by itself. But here we have a very interesting moment.
WSON.
The interesting moment is that, let's say we have a highly energetic photon, and say the energy of the photon is half of mega electron volt. Hey, here's the very good point. The potential of the alpha particle is 5 mega electron volts. Now this thing is a highly energetic photon. But the photon doesn't have a mass, belongs probably to the spectral place of the gamma and below. Now it hits the nuclei and it frees the electron, but it creates an electron and the anti-electron that would be the antimatter, which is a 2008 Titan laser with 1 millimeter thick gold target that creates positron electrons. So we're talking about energy much less than the energy of the one single alpha nuclei, which is doable. And we're talking about energy that is being known. We know that that they were the able to capture that. The only thing is about separation. They cannot create a black hole in here. But the separation is being done in other things. That's why I pointed to you the video about the standing wave. And to HGM. For the gentleman that is GGGG. Excuse my word, you are an idiot. Okay, thank you very much. The thing is that if you have a standing wave and you have a pressure wave, those droplets of water react as a trap. There is your positioning. I have the paper that I told you about, which actually says about particles and antiparticles production. It is in Wikipedia also a production. So we're not talking about something that is imagined is going to be in the future. And to Adrian.
What I think you're saying, Wes, is that some of these black holes and neutron stars do have what looks like the North Pole and the South Pole, an intense chunk of energy squirting out of there at very high velocity. And maybe those chunks of energy out of there is antimatter being rejected by... You might have a positive matter black hole, and what antimatter falls into it gets rejected by those beams coming off the North Pole and the South Pole. Pure speculation, maybe. I know that Paul wanted to ask or say something here. WS2N, K2RIW, go ahead, Paul.
Like what Wesley's talking about is something similar to Brian Greene's that he writes books. Last one I read was Elegant Universe, and he, in that book, states that you get your black hole, and you could, as matter is, he believes matter is being created in an empty space, but he believes space really is not empty. And they hear these regular matter and antimatter that's being created simultaneously, and at the event horizon where the black hole is, it's possible, probable in his case, that there is a possibility that it's going to be sucking in matter. It might just suck in the regular matter, and then the antimatter will not get sucked in. It just happens to be on the event horizon. Just like gravitational pull, it's going to pull some stuff in, some stuff it won't. Well, if it doesn't pull in the antimatter, that stuff will float off the space and just keep on going like forever. My guess is that's what he's talking about. It's tough to figure out, but I think that's what he's talking about. Back to you there, WS.
QSO and QSLW with a comment.
Go ahead, John.
Okay, if the anti matter doesn't, the antimatter doesn't respond to gravity the way regular matter does, it wouldn't get near the event horizon of the black hole. It wouldn't be attracted. If it does get near the event horizon, I believe from what I've read that that area of the black hole is tipping the matter apart using gravity and a very high temperature. So you're not going to get any matter escaping, so take your choice.
Yeah, I think you're right, John. So first of all, is there going to be antimatter in the vicinity of the black hole, that portion of its galaxy or universe? We can speculate about that. And is it going to fall toward the black hole in the first place? If antimatter operates in the opposite manner with gravity, that it folds up instead of falls down, which is yet to be confirmed, but that sure would be interesting. John, I wonder if you had a chance to read your mail back. I know it's a little bit too late for those guys. However, some of those guys can go to the website, amateurradio.tangovictor, and play it back that way. So even though we're kind of late for them and they've already gone to bed, the younger ones, still, you may have run into a good-sounding mailbag, KC2WGB, and awful glad you're in good health, K2IW Invicta. You got to be careful with those medications, John. You got it, John.
KC2WGB. Oh, you're absolutely right, Dick. Being a diabetic, insulin dependent, 35 years, I learned something I didn't know about diabetes, and I really have to pay attention to it. But that's a discussion for another time. Yeah, I have a couple of antenna questions, but I have one interesting science question from a young ham who does family. So I'm going to broach that one first, if that's all right with you.
It's your choice, John. And with 35 years of experience, what is that magic piece of information that you just discovered in the last week about insulin, John? Does the body build up some kind of a change in its performance, and therefore you've got to make some kind of an adjustment after 35 years? Because whatever you're about to say could be valuable information, even though it's a little off to one side. KC2WGB, K2LIW.
Well, Dick, you hit it right on the head, and it is quite important a piece of information. I'll give you a quick synopsis of what happened. Thursday, I normally had my dinner, took my insulin, and went to bed. I woke up, usual time, around 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning, took the dog out, and did what I do in the morning, and came back in, took my insulin, watched the news, and I forgot to eat, and I went to bed. Let me let it drop. And, of course, what happened? An insulin reaction took place. But normally, when I have low blood sugar, hypoglycemic, I get diaphoretic. You lose the ability to function in certain mental tasks, like operating a remote control, Dick. You want to change the channel. You know what button to push. But for some reason, the brain does not put the thumb in the right position. It's really confusing. So you know you're diaphoretic, you know that you're having mental things, you get blurry vision, and I know my sugar's low. Immediately take something and it goes. Now my magic number is 47. When I get near 47, that's when that starts to happen to me. Well, as you have different episodes, you can lose that response. Your body will no longer give you those warning signs, which is something I didn't know you could lose. You need absolutely no signs and go in and just go into a coma or an insulin shock. And that's what happened to me.
Wow. I presume someone else in the house recognized the fact that you were not responding the right way and therefore reacted accordingly. Is that approximately what happened, John? Go ahead.
Yes, well, my doggy started to bark, and I was on the floor flailing and doing all kinds of things, and totally couldn't communicate, which I don't. don't remember any of that. I just fell out of bed, which is only maybe an 18-inch drop, but they heard the noise, and that's when they came into the room with the dog barking and all, and that's how I was found. They called EMS, and they came, and something else, I was extremely combative. They had a terrible time. It took like four people to hold me down, and these guys are pretty big. So, yeah, and that's something I never experienced before, and I'm usually a calm guy. Don't go through that, so... And my sugar level, I think, had gone down to like 37, and they said it was almost over for me. It was very sobering.
I'm having the impression, John, if you were living alone as a person all by himself, that sounds to me like it was very life-threatening. Wow. With what you now know, if you happen to know you're going to be living alone for a while, what kind of protection is there from this kind of an event, John? KC2WGB, KQLAW.
KC2WGB. Oh, excellent question, Jim. It would have been over. There would have been no... if I was alone, there would have been no answer. But I have found now there is a subcutaneous injection module they have now, which they could have used. Of course, I wouldn't be able to use it because I was out of it. But there really is no answer. You need somebody there. So the truth of the matter is, my own stupidity, my own ignorance, I should have made sure that I ate, and I usually do. I pay pretty strict attention to it, and I just forgot to eat and went upstairs and went to bed, and when you lay down, you're asleep, you go into that mode without even realizing it. So, wow, that was scary.
No doubt about it. That is scary. Awful glad somebody else in the house heard the thump, knew something was going on, heard the dog barking. Wow. Once emergency services arrived and they applied corrective action, I'm guessing like within a fraction of an hour you're back into normal operation, John. Is that true?
Actually, Dick, once you can get glucose into your system, it only takes about 10 minutes. And, you know, you're back, you're coherent, and it's like, what happened, guys? And, of course, there's no recalling what went on. I remember everything up to the point where I actually went to sleep. But after that, no memory at all. But, yeah, I was just very fortunate. Absolutely.
Need to see you, okay? Mr. CUK, I think it was. Go right ahead.
Good evening, Dick. Oh, I just was checking out a radio here. And heard you talking about the diabetic experience. Well, I got to tell you, I've been living with it for about 28 years with my wife, and I can understand everything that's happening to you. And I wonder how often you check your sugar, and if you have a plan for like how much insulin to take with how many carbs do you eat.
Yeah, these are gone good questions, Bill. And I think your wife, like you said, is diabetic, and you've been keeping track of things like this. And also you said, John, I know you're more than 35 years of age, so you said you're diabetic for 35 years. I'm going to guess that means mature onset. So go ahead with any of that information, John. Good stuff. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, Dick, I believe it's called type 2, maturity onset, absolutely. And what I normally do, I try to keep basically a very boring life. I try to eat the same thing every day, all of the time. This way I know almost exactly how much insulin, and I can tell my blood sugar by how I feel. So I thought, up to this point I could. But now I just have to make sure I can't rely on that response of going into the diaphoretic condition or blurry vision and loss of brain function. It's amazing how foggy the brain can get. So I basically, my style is I use a long-acting insulin, which is type N, and I take 30 units twice a day. That I had upped it in the winter time because during the winter I snack a little more and I put on a little weight during the winter because I'm more sedentary. What I did was I forgot to adjust it and bring it back down. I went up to 40 units a day, twice a day, and I should have went back to 30. I would have been fine. But, yeah, my era, total, besides the ignorance of the other one system, just a little stupidity.
Well, make another guess here, John, and you can say you agree or don't know, and that is any medication you give a human being, you have to do a very careful balance between the rate of infusion and the rate of metabolism. As you put any kind of a pharmaceutical into a human being, the liver, among other things, is metabolizing at a certain rate. And for, in order for you to have a certain amount of the substance in your body to get the beneficial effect, you've got to be injecting it or infusing it the same at some carefully controlled rate as a function of knowing that it's also being metabolized at some rate. And so in the case of Coumadin, for instance, a person could go on using a certain rate of it, and it works pretty good for a year or two or three, and then for whatever reason, the body's rate of metabolizing changes, in many cases decreases, and therefore what was normally a normal dose becomes an overdose. And if it's not being carefully tracked, some terrible things can happen. I'm guessing that insulin infusion has some of those characteristics. In other words, as you age, as your metabolism changes, as your rate of metabolism changes, my guess is some form of adjustment is required, and the measurements required in order to properly do that titration and adjustment sounds to me it's not easy. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
KC2WGB. Well, absolutely, Dick, and there's a thing called you develop insulin resistance over a period of time, too. That's another thing that can happen where you may have to take more in some cases than other. I don't check my sugar as often as I should. Of course, I will be paying attention to that until I make sure I'm back on course. But that's another thing that I really wasn't doing enough times a day. Sometimes I would go a week without doing it because basically I didn't change my diet. But then there's also the amount of exercise. The better the weather, the more outside I am and the more things I do. So you burn up more calories and therefore don't need as much insulin. So it's a tough balance.
Okay, with a comment.
Go ahead, Bill.
Gail had a similar problem. She was getting anywhere between 8 and 10 units before meals, varying on her readings. And she started getting low, and on her three-month visit to the endocrinologist, he said, well, you know, she's losing a little bit of weight, which is good. She had a little bit extra weight, and as the weight dropped, the insulin dropped. And I'm very careful to measure out anything with carbs, the bread, the potatoes, the rice, whatever she eats with carbs. I weigh it out, and I know pretty much within a unit or two of insulin how much to give her. Of course, sometimes something strange will happen. If I give her a banana in the morning that's too ripe, she'll be high for lunch. So she has type 1, which is really hard to control. I have a hard time trying to keep it below 200. And tonight we ate a Chinese meal. She usually gets a snack about 9:30. She wasn't hungry, so I'm not going to force the issue. She also, John, uses Lantus, which is a long-acting insulin. She takes that at night, about 20 units. And, John, I want to ask you, were you at the Hamfest today?
God, I think he just got out of the hospital. I kind of doubt it. Go ahead, John.
Only in heart and mind. Absolutely not. It's a trip. And thank God that's only, besides mental issues, that's the only thing I have wrong with me. And I'm handling it so far, it's half my life, actually, about half my life I'm a diabetic. So I've done pretty well, and I feel good. And actually, when I was brought to the hospital, by the time I got to the hospital, all the symptoms were gone. Of course, you know, that it also has other things too, Dick. They kept me in because my white count went sky high, and they told me, it may not be an infection. It's very possible that the reaction with the low blood sugar can cause the brain to read the data wrong, and it will start manufacturing white cells like crazy. And sure enough, they were right. By maybe 8 hours in the hospital, the count went back down to my normal 11. So there's many things. Besides being an insidious disease, it's very complex.
As a non-diabetic, John, from time to time I read articles about developments taking place where people are trying to develop instrumentation that automatically makes measurements and does insulin infusion. So I know that a number of medical institutions have attempted to do this, because for a human being to try to keep track of exactly how many carbs he's consumed at what hour of the day and how much insulin he's injected, to keep track of that and to keep it balanced is far from easy. As such, an automatic system would be great. I suspect now that you're going to tell us that, yes, there's been lots of proposals, but not very much high success in that area so far. I'm going to be asking that of both you and John and Bill. Let's see. So where are we in the spectrum of automatic machinery doing this, John? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Well, Dick, you're right. They do have a computer. One is a very very nice one that mounts sort of like a pacemaker inside, and there's a port to fill it, and it dispenses insulin as required. It's actually measuring your blood sugar levels and giving you what you need. So as soon as it sees no intake of food, of course it doesn't dispense insulin, and as you take it, this is excellent for the young children, especially the brittle diabetics, because they're very hard to control. So, yeah, there are three systems that are in development. One is working, but it's not out on the market yet, and they hope to have that out in the next 3 or 4 years.
I'm wondering, John, why is it only being used on children? Because they're more difficult to adjust and more difficult to measure. But for a person of your resources, if there was a successful system that had a reasonable track record, wouldn't that be worth considering for you to install one of those? Over to you, John.
Yes, Dick, of course. I didn't mean to say that it's only being used for children, but it's going to be a great benefit for children because they're very difficult to handle. Yeah, they are installing them in people. They have some test models out that seem to be... They don't have a track record yet, but that's what they're establishing. If it was on the market and it was accepted and my doctor recommended it, yeah, absolutely, I would do it.
So let me ask Bill this question. Now, Bill, have any of, I believe your wife's name is Gail, have any of her physicians made suggestions that sometime in the near future there will be an automatic system available for your wife which could do some of this in a much easier manner? Not much easier than that. It's the B2CUK, K2LIW in the tech net.
Yeah, K2LIW, WB2CUK. You know, they have pumps. They have these pumps that'll, but I think the pump is set. I think you have to set the pump for a certain amount of delivery. And I think they have things that you can wear that will give you the sugar reading. But I don't think they really have combined the two. And Gail is considered sort of a brittle diabetic. In fact, the doctor said that she sometimes might produce her own insulin, which would cause her to get low. But, yeah, she checks herself 3 times a day. And, Dick, I have to sign. It's getting late. I just got to get her lanterns ready and get to bed. I got to get up early tomorrow and get my car inspected and all that. Anyway, you might comment on how this radio sounds, because I'm just checking it out. I picked it up at the Ham Fest. I was going to say, if you were at the Ham Fest, the heat can really affect your sugar. That could really, drain the energy out of you. Dick, over to you, and I'm going to sign. This is WB2CUK, off of Claire. We'll talk to you next week.
Bill, that's a good-sounding radio. Nice audio, just the right amount of it. However, whether you're using that radio or the radio you normally use when you're running the swap and shop, in either case, your particular antenna and the connection to the repeater is a little bit noisy, a little bit of hiss in the background, and it's a normal amount of hiss. So signal strength-wise, it'd be great if you had a little bit more power, a little bit more antenna, but that's not to blame the radio for. But the radio sounds good. Sounds like you made a good purchase. I think you said, John, you've got an antenna question or another question of a guy who can stay up late, so go right ahead. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
And good night, Bill. Always enjoy the swap and shop. And thanks for being there. Yeah, Dick. I got a little science question here from a guy who definitely told me he could stay up late. So let me go to drop and get it. KC2WGB. Okay, Dick. This young ham would like to know. His science question is this: if we were to take, we'll take a couple of ounces of water, and we're going to put it in a little rectangle in a box, and we're going to take it to outer space. Now it has pressure; it will maintain the atmospheric pressure, 14 pounds. We're not going to apply any heat to it or anything else. Just send it into space. Now, will it go into space and stay as a misshapen cloud? Will it go into a spherical shape? Will the molecules start to separate? What happens if it's shaken? Will it stay or will it recombine? Those kind of questions. This is all, of course, before it freezes. So maybe you could help him out on that, because he's seen some very interesting things with the space station, and he'd like to know a little more about what's going on up there.
Yeah, there was a student who asked an extremely interesting question. Can't remember the astronaut's name, who's on the International Space Station. And at the request of the student, the International Space Station astronaut carried on the experiment. And that was, in the pressurized atmosphere inside the space station, if you took a washcloth that's filled, that's soaking with water, and you wrung it out. When you do that on Earth, you do that over your sink, you wring out the cloth, the water comes out of the cloth and drips into the sink. What happens when you do that in the microgravity in orbit on the space shuttle? And you can go to a website and you can watch it happen. Fascinating. He wrung the space cloth. You see the water come out of the space cloth, and the water stays right there. It stays clumped around the face cloth. It doesn't, there is no gravity, it can't drip down. It comes out of the cloth, but stays on the surface of the cloth. And unless he waved it in some way, it wouldn't move. Any chunk of water that you put, if an astronaut very gently released some water out of his mouth, for instance, and did it with no velocity, the water he released into the microgravity of the space station would always form into a quasi-spherical shape. It bounces around a little bit, but water has surface tension, and it will always form itself into a spherical shape in microgravity. However, there's a catch. Let me drop. Whenever water is above absolute zero, it always has something called vapor pressure. It doesn't matter if it's heavily frozen as ice, as a liquid that's cold, a liquid that's hot, a liquid that's boiling, there is always a vapor pressure. And you can look up the word vapor pressure, you can Google that, and at 14.7 pounds per square inch of air, at, let me pick a number, at 70 degrees Fahrenheit, water might have a vapor pressure of half a pound per square inch. In other words, water molecules are continuously boiling off the surface of the water. They're boiling off much, much more slowly of the surface of the ice, but molecules are always boiling off the surface. In the case of a completely closed container of water, what eventually happens is that the air above the water will go to exactly 100% humidity. What that really means is that water is boiling off the surface of the liquid, going into the gaseous state in the air above the water. A certain rate of the water molecules in the air are reforming back onto the water liquid. It's flowing in both directions continuously. Here's what's going on, and it's a little bit close to what happens when you get out of the shower after taking a shower. Let me drop. You climb out of your nice warm shower. You stand on your mat outside of the shower, as most people do, and you pick up the towel and you're about to start drying yourself off. And you suddenly realize how cold you feel. And you know that water is evaporating off your body, and you're feeling cold, and you wonder why. And there's three or four different ways of explaining it. Water has a 540 calories per gram of heat of vaporization. In other words, whenever you boil off water from the liquid state, absorb 540 calories of heat in the process of going from the liquid state to the gaseous state. That's one way of looking at it. There you know how much, but you don't know why. The real question is, hey, when I climb out of the shower, or I've been swimming in the ocean, and I walk up to the shore, and my body is still wet, I feel cold. Why do I feel cold? Yeah, water is evaporating, and this 540 calories per gram is the magnitude. But what's really happening? Those water molecules are continuously moving. They're moving at a ridiculous rate. They're bouncing around in all kinds of crazy directions. The water, each individual water molecule is a bipolar molecule. In other words, one end is more positive. I think it's the end with the two hydrogens, and the other end is more negative, the end with the oxygen. So water molecules are slightly polarized, each individual molecule. As such, they tend to stick together. The positive end of one sticks to the negative end of another. So these water molecules moving around in the liquid state are continuously forming relationships and breaking relationships as they're bouncing all over the place. Okay. If you plot it as a graph, the velocity of the water molecules, I know this is a much longer answer than he asked for, but you'd be amazed how much this will all help, and we'll eventually get there. Stand by. Those water molecules are moving around, I think the answer is 640 meters per second of average speed. They're bouncing in all kinds of crazy directions. Average is 640 meters per second. But if I made a graph where the horizontal axis is the velocity of individual water molecules and the vertical axis is their probability, you would find a Gaussian-shaped curve, a bell-shaped curve. The center of the curve would be 640 meters per second. But to the left of that peak in the curve, some of them are moving a hell of a lot slower. To the right of that peak of the curve, some of them are moving a hell of a lot faster. Okay. You know that there's something called surface tension. In other words, the ones on the surface are attracted to their brethren down below, and there is no similar attraction up above. So the surface tension of a liquid acts like it's got a skin. And you've watched certain kinds of insects walk across the surface of water. The surface tension allows them to do that. Or you can take a razor blade and very carefully deposit it on the surface of water, and it will float. You know darn well that the steel of the razor blade is a hell of a lot heavier than the water, and yet you can float a razor blade. It's because of surface tension. Okay, here's what's really happening in the case of you getting cold. You climb out of the shower, some of those water molecules, some of those water droplets on your body, at the microscopic level, at the atomic level, there's individual water molecules moving real fast. Some of those water molecules moving at 640 or higher meters per second roar up to the surface. They're moving at a high velocity up to the surface of the water, and they leave. Because they were moving so fast, they leave. The ones that have the highest velocity are the ones that are most likely to leave. The ones that have low velocity come up to the surface, surface tension takes over, they're held down by glue, so to speak, and they don't leave. The fast ones are the ones that leave. Your thermometer measures something we call temperature. What is temperature? Average speed of the molecules. The hot ones are the fast ones. The fast ones are the ones that are leaving. The hot ones that are leaving. So of the individual water molecules, some of them moving fast, some of them moving slow, at the atomic level, you could say some of them are hot and some of them are cold. Kind of hard to believe, but it is taking place. The hot ones are the ones that leave. The cold ones are the ones that stay. Therefore, you feel cold. There's always vapor pressure. There's always material boiling off the surface. The hot ones are the ones that leave. That evaporation gives you cooling by that procedure. Okay? That's what happens with air pressure. There is always a certain vapor pressure. In other words, the rate at which molecules are boiling off the surface of water. Let me drop. There's a fixed rate at which molecules are always boiling off the surface of water. It's only a function of the temperature of the water. And it's a little bit of a function of the local air pressure. But that temperature of the water tells you how fast. The so-called vapor pressure you can look up for water at any temperature you care about. You find out what the vapor pressure is. It's really telling you how fast the water molecules are boiling off. And in the case of a closed container, the humidity, they keep boiling off until the humidity goes to 100%, and that's at the point at which the rate at which they boil off and the rate at which they come back from the gaseous state to the liquid state are balancing each other. That happens at room temperature. put a chunk of water in a vacuum, it boils immediately. One of the experiments you can do, and it's often done in chemistry classes and physics classes, is you can be using a vacuum pump above a flask of water. You've got a flask of, you got some water in the bottom of an Erlenmeyer flask. You've got a cork in the top. A piece of tubing comes out of that cork, and it goes into something like a vacuum pump. And so you soon discover that you take that piece of tubing coming out, and you expose it to the air so that the air pressure inside and outside is the same. And you put your Erlenmeyer flask on top of your Bunsen burner, and you heat up the water to 100 degrees centigrade. You watch it boil, and you watch steam come off of that piece of tubing. Okay? You now connect a vacuum pump to that piece of tubing. You let the water cool off to not 100 degrees centigrade, but 95 degrees centigrade. You start operating the vacuum pump, and you realize the water will boil again. You cool it off a little bit more, you do a little bit more vacuum, and the water will boil again. The bottom line, if you keep carrying out the experiment, is you can bring water down to almost 0 degrees centigrade, almost the freezing temperature of water.
Repeater, timeout.
The water is just a little bit above freezing. You create enough of a vacuum above it. Because the water, at every temperature, water has a certain vapor pressure. You create that amount of vacuum equal or below that so-called vapor pressure, and the water will boil. As you know that when you go to the top of a mountain and you try to cook your potatoes, because you're up at a high altitude where the air pressure is lower, water doesn't boil at 100 degrees centigrade anymore. It'll boil at 90 degrees centigrade. Your potatoes will cook a hell of a lot slower on top of a mountain. By the same token, once that water is at, let me pick a number, 1 degree centigrade, which is probably about 33 or 34 degrees Fahrenheit, just barely above freezing, you create enough vacuum and the water will boil. You've made the vapor pressure above the water lower than the natural vapor pressure of the water, and it will boil. So any water you put into space in a vacuum will very rapidly disappear by way of a boiling-like process. There's a catch to that, though. The astronauts have a little bit of a problem. They periodically do something that's called a urine dump. In other words, the so-called restroom that's on the space shuttle, or the restroom that's on the International Space Station, I think nowadays they take almost all of the fluid and put it through a filtering process and reuse it. But in the old days, in the case of the early shuttle, they would take the urine connected into a tank, and they would periodically dump it overboard. Okay. You would assume the urine dumped overboard would immediately vaporize, turn into a vapor, and go out into space and never come back. Well, urine does contain some other substances. And so it occasionally would form a chunk of what looks like ice right at the exit tube of the space shuttle where they've done the urine dump. And occasionally the chunk of ice would jam up the process. And so can you get a solid chunk of ice in space? Well, it looks like ice because it contains materials.
Repeater, timeout.
It looks like ice because it contains certain solid materials, and much of the fluid has boiled off. And I don't think you can sustain ice in space. If it's really pure water and you put it into space and it was a chunk of ice, every chunk of ice at some particular temperature has a vapor pressure and it's slowly boiling off. And so your ice is going to slowly disappear. That's what I know, but there's an exception. And that is, they've been making measurements in that very hard vacuum in space that you've got on the surface of the moon, and they believe in some of those craters at the north pole of the moon that never see any sunlight. They believe there is frozen water below the surface. Same thing with Mars. They believe there's frozen water below the surface of Mars. Mars has an extremely low air pressure, a couple of tenths of 1% of the air pressure on Mars compared to Earth, and the vapor pressure, the air pressure on the moon, is a much, much lower temperature yet. So how can there be frozen water below the surface of the moon that didn't boil away? How can there be frozen water below the surface of Mars that didn't boil away? That's a little bit of a mystery to me. But in general, the water that's in your body would immediately go into a boiling process if you put your body into a hard vacuum, and terrible things would happen. You don't want to do that. So can you have water in a vacuum, in a liquid form? I think the answer is essentially no. But in the air pressure they've got inside the shuttle, water forms into a nice spherical object because of surface tension. That's some of the answer. KC2WGB, KQLIW in the TechNet.
WSN, quick comment.
Go ahead, Paul, first.
It's fun to go on the internet and download the pressure-temperature relation charts. We used to get them years ago before the internet, but you know, you get one for water, you get one for ammonia, for the different freons, and a lot of different chemicals. Pressure-temperature relationship charts, they're very good. PT charts, they're cool. 7-H-1-1.
I still recognize, but Paul, first, did you finish what you wanted to say, Paul?
Yeah, Dick, PT charts. Pressure-temperature relation charts. Download them from the internet. It's interesting to see the where these different fluids will boil. You know, at what pressure? Fascinating. You know, and some of them will exist at room temperature, and some of them won't. It's amazing, including water.
Understand. And when it comes to the cooling you get when water is evaporating off your body, at the molecular level, I've got an explanation that works for me, and I think it's accurate, but I've never read it. The fact that the hot molecules are the ones that leave and the cold ones are the ones that stay, because those are the ones that roar up to the surface at a high velocity and decide to leave. There is a similar process when gaseous water vapor goes back into liquid form and forms rain, and it's that process that powers a thunderstorm, a hurricane, and tornadoes. And the opposite process, what's sustaining the hurricane or tornado, I think I have figured that one out. But we won't go there right yet. But who is it now that just went to mail? Oh, yeah, Joe, WB2RYY. And you should be sleeping at this time. Go ahead, Joe. K2RYW with your comment. You got it, Joe.
I actually just want to find out if anybody had brought up this subject of a new asteroid or something else that they just found recently. Maybe it's not recently. Any more news about this thing? I just heard on the news last week something approximately 1.4 miles in length that's going to make a fairly close pass to Earth. Any news about that thing?
If you go to spaceweather.com, they have a chart at the beginning and at the bottom of their first page, which shows you all of the known near-Earth objects and in how many lunar distances, and sometimes it's a fraction of a lunar distance, like 0.5, how many lunar distances is it going to pass us, and then what date is it going to do it. So they're always discovering a whole bunch of near-Earth objects. And I think I've been hearing about one that's one and a fraction miles in dimension, and I think it's going to pass by at a couple of lunar distances. Paul, you probably know about this. WS2N, K2LIW.
I think that's the one in November, Dick.
I don't want to hold it, but yeah, I heard about a week ago about 19 lunar distances. 19 lunar distances, that one's going to come. One that's 1.5 miles. Back to you, Dick.
Now, the fact that it's 1.5 miles, it means that the chances of hitting the Earth are very, very low. However, 1.5 miles of dimension of an object, if it happened to hit our atmosphere, would be quite a bit beyond the size of the one that hit Tunguska in Russia around 1908 or 1909, I think it was. I think the one that hit Russia in February that injured 1,000 people and burst a whole lot of windows and whatever. I think that one was only a couple of hundred feet in dimension. I'm going to pass it back to Paul for a correction on that. So as it gets larger and larger in dimension and hits our atmosphere, and that one that hit Russia in February gave out an amount of energy because of that impact with the atmosphere and the heating, that amount of energy, which I believe was a couple of times beyond the energy of the Hiroshima atomic bomb. The only reason it didn't create a hell of a lot more damage to people is that it was doing it at many miles of altitude. It wasn't down at the surface level. So roughly how big was the one in February? And I think the one that you just mentioned that comes by in November, I believe it's of the size of the Tunguska event, maybe beyond. WS2N, KQLIW.
Okay, no, I don't remember. In fact, I'm trying to remember the Yucatan one. Wasn't that six mile object that supposedly wiped out all the dinosaurs, Vic? That was a 6 mile diameter thing. So that'll change the Earth forever. And I don't recall the Russian one. The one for 1908 was, I think that was only supposed to be, was that a 600 feet? Not a huge thing, but 600 feet. But you know, when it comes in like that, it completely evaporates the word, but explodes high above the atmosphere. They're lucky to find any remnants of it. And that's why it creates such damage. I think that's the other same thing that happened in Russia. I don't even know if there's anything left. I came back from that one that blew up in Russia, you know, last February.
Yeah, as the object gets bigger and bigger, as its angle of impact gets more and more steep, it therefore has more and more energy to dissipate and comes closer and closer to penetrating all the way down to the atmosphere, down to the surface of the Earth. In the case of the Yucatan Peninsula, that particular event, very similar to the one in Arizona, you get a big enough object at a high enough velocity, at a steep enough angle of impact, where it goes down to the surface, it will create a nuclear winter. In other words, the total energy dissipated is so large, it fluffs up so darn much of the...
Repeater, timeout.
It will fluff up so much of the soil of the Earth that it creates a nuclear winter. In other words, all of that sunlight-blocking material in the atmosphere lowers the albedo of the Earth, or Earth, it changes the reflectivity of the Earth so that the solar energy no longer gets down to the surface. The Earth goes into a kind of an ice age. Most of the plants die. Most of the animals that depend on the plants starve to death. Most of the other animals, the carnivores that eat the first set of animals, they starve to death. And so when it comes to the five significant mass extinctions we've had on the Earth, this kind of a nuclear winter, as it's called, it's not really nuclear, but you know what I mean, a big enough impact could do it. And so you got to worry about how fast is it moving, how big is it, and how much damage is going to happen when it hits the Earth. Let me drop.
Oh, before the witching hour.
Yeah, I know we're getting very close. And so we didn't get very far with the question, but water in space is a complicated subject. Water evaporating, creating water vapor. Boiling off the surface of the ocean.
He had one other issue, Dick.
Go ahead, John. You got it.
He wanted to know your opinion of if you were to take this closed box and shake the water up, break it up, what do you think would happen? Would it recombine and go back to its original style, maybe like a cloud formation, or would it stay separate? That was one of his major questions. Back to you, Dick. KC2WQB.
I'm assuming the box is completely closed. You've got a certain amount of water and a certain amount of air in the box. And you shake it up so that now you've got a real fine mixture of water globules and air because you've shaken it violently. Because water always has surface tension, as it floats around in that box, if it was in free space with no gravity, and even if you had gravity, in the case of on the Earth, the water will eventually all form in the bottom of the box. In the case of being in free space, you still have those molecules floating around. They're going to find each other, and they're going to stick together by the surface tension. Therefore, in my opinion, if you did the experiment extremely carefully, there's a slim possibility you could form a round ball of water in the center of the box. Extremely slim possibility of doing that. 99.9% of the time, the water molecule, the water glob, will touch the surface of the box, and it will now, because of the surface tension, it'll attract itself to the box and smear itself across the wall. And so it'll be a quasi-ball-shaped chunk of water plastered up against the side of the box, is my belief. Now, you could choose a substance on the lining of the inside of the box where water really sheds very easily, like Teflon and some other substances. And if you did that, if you lined the box with something that really sheds water, like Teflon, I think you could, in free space, with no gravity, in microgravity, you could get the water to form a spherical ball in the center of the box, in my opinion. KC2WGB, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. All of his questions are answered. He should have a lot of fun with that. I don't know where he's going to get a box to take up in space with him, but if he ever gets there, he'll be able to find out. I think Paul had another question, Dick. Back to you, KC2WGB.
You've got it, Paul.
And John, by the way, a lot of young people come up with questions like that, and next thing you know, they find their experiment, well, in the old days on the space shuttle, but they'll find it on their way up to the International Space Station. So, good ideas. Just want to quick give out my email for any questions and topics of this sort. Astronomy, space launches. The email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. spacenetreport@gmail.com. All one word. Back to you, Dick. WS1.
Okay, that's the way you talk to Paul, the man who gathers all of our information about space and what NASA, National Aeronautics and Space Administration, is doing. I'm going to go back and do a little bit more reading to make sure I didn't have my facts too bollocked up on the alpha magnetic spectrometer and the fact that something like 40% of the cosmic ray electrons that it has measured to date, and I think there's something like 400 of those events, something like 40% of them were positrons. Very high velocity, very high energy cosmic rays. In other words, the stuff that's coming from outside of our solar system for sure, and maybe outside of our galaxy, that I don't know, but the high power stuff coming at us as cosmic rays, a significant percentage of them, once you've got the right kind of a detector up in space, are antimatter, positrons. Darn significant to me. I think we're starting to see the fact that the great big mystery, where's all the antimatter? It's there. We just weren't in the right place using the right kind of a detector to see it. We're getting pretty low on our time. It's going to be closing up pretty soon. This was TechNet number 1,452. I may be one or two numbers low on that. On the TechNet that began way back in September of 1982, 30 and a half years ago. As long as John and I and Paul stay healthy, and we're working on that, we'll be back again next week and try to dig into some more of this stuff, of this crazy universe, which is a little bit complicated, but we're slowly understanding it. And that's a funny statement, as you know. There's a lot to go yet. And so how does that radio wave travel through 11 billion miles from... Okay, we'll be... How does that radio wave travel through 11 billion miles? We'll be talking about some of the stuff in the future. By Scott, by the John, by the Paul, by the West. See you guys later.
That's very good. Next, that's the last 2 months. We'll be here next week.
a little bit noisier than it used to be if you're going through the cell index, but a little bit noisier. But usually a little bit after the next. Good hungry, but have you asked right there?
Echo 7 Lima Tango Delta tested. VE7 LTD testing 1-2-3. This is Victor Echo 7 Lima Tango Delta with an audio test. Audio test 1-2-3 VE7 LTD.
Thank you for visiting the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system, node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link clear.
Auto connecting.
Node number 9126.
Welcome to the Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club repeater system. Node number 9126 on the New England reflector.
Link active.
W2HCB and 2PPN.
And 2PPN.